طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر. تسكله ماسا لون وطن، تسكله ماسا لون وطن، نفقا لعودة اللاجئين.
Welcome to the June 15th edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Fahm and kept going by a group of his dedicated friends. And every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a distinctly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States. On today's show, we feature an abbreviated talk by Max Blumenthal and Ali Abunia held on April 23, 2014 at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco about the future of Palestine. Max Blumenthal is an award-winning journalist and author. His latest book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Ali Abunia is a longtime Palestinian rights activist. His latest book is The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Please stay tuned for a thought-provoking discussion about Palestine.
I wanted to introduce Max Blumenthal, who is an award-winning journalist and best-selling author whose articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Daily Beast, the Nation, the Guardian, the Huffington Post, and Salon.com. Blumenthal's video documentaries have been seen on the Independent Film Channel and Al Jazeera English. His 2009 book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, is a New York Times and Los Angeles Times bestseller. His most recent book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Both his books and Ali Abunia's books will be on sale tonight and offer as a book signing afterward. But for now, I wanted to welcome Max Blumenthal.
Trying to check the vote at SDSU, which is having a divestment resolution.
It hasn't happened yet, but we're going to keep pressing.
But, you know, those of you who are live tweeting, you know, we're here for SDSU, SJP, in support of their divestment resolution, which is going on. Let me hear them smack the clock, whatever else noise you all can make. It's actually insane that they even have to fight to pass this resolution. It should be self-evident that such a resolution should pass to divest from corporations involved in human rights abuses. But there's one group on campus which is determined to prevent consequences for corporations which are involved in abusing and exploiting people worldwide. And it's a group that is being commissioned and orchestrated by the pro-Israel lobby. So we're going to talk about that tonight. Ali's book is one of the first books that really exposes how this whole campaign is operating, what's happening on campus, what's going to happen after the failed two-state solution, after Kerry's failed framework plan, which he actually called a framework for a framework. So this book, like Ali, is visionary. I've learned, you know, as a journalist that clear writing is a sign of clear thinking. And this book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, is really emblematic of that. It really presents clear thinking on an issue that most Americans find to be exceptionally complex. It's not very complex, as Ali illustrates. And he presents a vision for what should happen next, and he presents in very clear, accessible language how to, we are going to get there, how we're going to realize that vision. He answers the hard questions. One of the hardest questions, what happens to Israeli Jews once that vision of equality is realized? He offers historical context, and he offers a very humane and ethical vision, much more humane and ethical than what is being offered by the U.S. and being presented by liberal Zionists in the form of a two-state solution, which can actually, you know, be called a one-and-a-half-state solution at best. So I think, you know, in my book, Goliath doesn't present a vision. It presents...
It's kind of a nightmare.
There you go.
There we go. That's better.
And it really gives you a window into my experience working on the ground for about a year in Israel-Palestine, especially in Israeli society, especially in Jewish-Israeli society, which, unlike Ali, I have unique access to because, as a Jewish American with my special connection to Methuselah and Hem, Shem, and Japheth, I have more rights in the land of Israel-Palestine than any Palestinian in the whole world. Because of my J-positive blood. And I use that privilege to present you with this, what can only be described as a dystopian vision of Israel since 2009 under the control of the most right-wing government in its history, a permanent right-wing majority as long as the U.S.-encouraged status quo continues. And so I think Ali's book is the perfect coda to mine because it explains where we need to go next. And it also presents, in a very detailed and forensic way, what the pro-Israel lobby is doing to prevent us from getting there, to preserve the status quo, to censor this discussion. Ali has dealt with this for far longer than I have. I don't know my audience that well here, but in New York, I mean, when you order a bagel and you want a little bit of cream cheese, you say smear. Where you want a lot, you get a schmear. And we've been getting schmeared. Like, I was just accused of being of inspiring these killings by a neo-Nazi in Kansas City, you know, by major pro-Israel figures, Ron Radosh, Josh Block, the former spokesperson for AIPAC. Rush Limbaugh went on the air and said that I caused him to stab three Jews. Well, he shot three people who are non-Jewish outside Jewish community centers, and there's very little evidence to back it up. But it was you know.
I'd say there's no evidence.
There was absolutely no evidence.
Give yourself a bit more credit than that.
This was promoted by people paid by the Israeli government, like Avi Meyer, who is a kind of full-time social media troll with the Jewish Agency. And so, you know, the smears are continuous. You know, they attempted to blame a Jew for what a Nazi did, which is very anti-Semitic to me, and very conspiratorial. I don't know, why are Zionists so conspiratorial? But this is part of how this movement is operating, because they have nothing to offer. They have no positive narrative to offer. They only have smears and censorship and even prosecution. And we're seeing legislation being introduced at the state level. And it will soon be introduced at the federal level to punish BDS. So I want to just talk about that first. You talk in your book about Israel's war on BDS and the pro-Israel movement's war on BDS. I was just in Seattle, and the Olympia Co-op has successfully defeated a slap lawsuit that was filed against it by the Israeli government. The Israeli government filed a strategic lawsuit against public participation against a cooperative board that voted to divest from Israeli products in the United States. So there are actually, the Israeli government is coming into the United States through pro-Israel groups like Stand With Us and trying to prevent Americans from exercising their democratic rights and protected speech. My question to you, and you address this question in your book, is to what extent is it working? What impact is this having?
Well, thanks, Max, and thanks to everyone. I have to say, it's pretty overwhelming to be sitting up here with so many people, many friends. I see many friends in the room, and I'm really thrilled that you've come out to support us and to support the work we're doing. But You can't all be people we know. There's so many new faces here, and it's just amazing. Thank you for coming. And thank you to everyone who has worked to make this event possible. So, for those who don't know, BDS, that Max mentioned, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, it's a growing campaign. It's very simple. I mean, when you said, Max, that I tried to break things down in a simple way, one of the strategies of the Israel lobby, and I've seen this myself, you and I were both at the University of Michigan a few weeks ago, when hundreds, thousands of students were coming out to watch the student government debate a resolution on whether the University of Michigan should divest from companies that profit from Israeli occupation, Israeli militarism, and abuses of Palestinian human rights. And the students, the pro-Israel students who were coming up, and who had clearly been really well coached, were all making the same point one after another, that this issue is so complicated, don't worry your pretty little heads about it. So it's a line people have been fed that, you know, this is so complicated. And one of the things I wanted to do is really break it down and say it's not. People get this because in this country, in this city, you know, what are Israeli settlements except a more brutal and more violent form of gentrification? You know, you're taking out the wrong people, the wrong type of people, and bringing in the right type of people. That's, you know, something that we can relate to. And so for 4 years, I mean, it's going on for longer, but in the book I really trace it over the past 4 years, pro-Israel groups and the Israeli government have been pouring, I would conservatively say, tens of millions of dollars into efforts to suppress student activism, to manipulate social and cultural institutions. For example, here in San Francisco, the Israeli consulate was strategizing with the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival on how to defame Palestine solidarity activists. You know, it's everywhere. And I guess, I mean, I could ask you the question, Max. After all this effort, BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, is bigger than ever. Tonight, while we're sitting here, divestment resolutions are being debated at three California campuses, San Diego State University, UC Riverside, and UC Santa Barbara. Well, that's why we're checking the hashtags to see if there's a result. And so this is happening. And California passed H.R. 35 condemning this. As you said, there are laws all over the country, but repression is not working. I think the BDS train has left the station.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned... you mentioned the University of Michigan. I was kind of like parachuted into the University of Michigan at the last second to be the guest speaker at their debate on divestment. And it was an incredible scene. There were 600 people in the room. No one was allowed to snap or clap. I wasn't apprised of this fact, so I come in to do my shtick, you know, and I said, make some noise for these brave students. And all I got was finger wagging. And then, you know, but they did the spirit hands. And, you know, through them, you know, pro-Israel students have learned to do this. But, you know, there were 500 students waiting outside to see this take place. And I wasn't aware of the amount of energy the pro-Israel movement was spending just at University of Michigan alone. I mean, they've had to run around from campus to campus, from city to city, to try to put out fires. And they, as much money as they have, as much resources as they have, they can't seem to do it. One of the students who was leader of this divestment resolution was smeared in the Free Beacon, which is funded by Sheldon Adelson and Paul Singer, two of the biggest funders of the Republican Party, and is a neoconservative magazine in Washington, for cutting a pineapple. He had placed a photo of himself wearing a kufiyeh cutting a pineapple, because the pineapple was the ananas was the name of a rival basketball club in an Arab basketball.
I thought it was the ancient fruit of the Jewish people.
Well, why does he hate Hawaiians, is my question. And major pro-Israel figures, including Kenneth Marcus of the Brandeis Center, said that this was an anti-Semitic act, alluding to the Holocaust and cutting up Jews. I mean, if you want, I can spend, like, I don't want to waste any time explaining how he got there. But that was he pulled several muscles trying to smear this kid who, you know, had not an anti-Semitic bone in his body. The other students were accused of calling Jewish students on campus kikes, which is a word that I haven't heard since I watched Mad Men. I mean, it's not in the vocabulary of young people. These were fabricated smears that, you know, have really created a dangerous situation on campus for these students. And the smears were being pushed by the vice president of the student council, who is a former intern for AIPAC. So they're packing these student councils with students who have been indoctrinated, who are heavily involved in pro-Israel activism. The vote was completely stacked. They got two guest speakers. One claimed that he was an impartial historian who is a professor at the school. But I Googled some of his writing on Israel-Palestine, and he was, you know, about as Zionist as you can get. And he laundered all his opinions behind the Israeli narrative. So they got twice the amount of time. And in the end, the student paper endorsed BDS and said it's one of the most pressing causes of our time. What I saw among these students was so impressive. I was just at the University of Washington where they introduced their divestment resolution. It's happening from campus to campus to campus. But you talk about the battle on campus. I mean, where is it going, and why is this significant? Because generally, these resolutions do get voted down. The Israel lobby has spent a lot of money cultivating students at the top and making sure that these votes are defeated. So what's the point of doing this?
Well, that's a great question. And in the book, I talk about an organization called the David Project. This is a multi-million dollar pro-Israel organization founded by someone called Charles Jacobs, a really virulent Islamophobe. And they got their start basically running smear campaigns against individual professors. Their first and most prominent target was Professor Joseph Massad, the brilliant Professor Joseph Massad at Columbia University. And 10 years later, their smear campaign is still running. But now what they focused on is kind of more a nationwide effort to shut down Palestine solidarity campaigns, and really even teaching an academic inquiry about Palestine and the U.S. role in supporting Israel on campus. And the reason, and I quote them in the book, the reason they're focusing on campuses is because they say that the future of the U.S.-Israel relationship is going to be decided on campus. That is where the opinions of the future generations of, you know, elites in the U.S., opinion makers, are formed. And if we don't shut this down now, in, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, it's really, you know, Israel will lose its last major sponsor, which is the United States. So the David Project lays out a strategy that includes vicious tactics. They actually use the term, they say that we should go out and accuse professors of academic malpractice when they teach things that are displeasing to the David Project. In California, this has been happening. You know, there have been efforts to get individual professors prosecuted, for example, for using their personal websites that are hosted on California State University servers to advocate their opinions about Palestine. And professors set up their personal websites, they link to things. In fact, one professor, there was an effort by a pro-Israel group in California to have a professor prosecuted for including links to the Electronic Intifada, the website that I co-edit, on his personal website. But it's even much bigger than that. You mentioned someone called Kenneth Marcus at the Brandeis Center. What they've been doing is using the U.S. Civil Rights Act, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, to file complaints against universities claiming that administrators are allowing a pervasive atmosphere of anti-Semitism on campus. And when these complaints have been adjudicated, either by federal judges in the case of UC Berkeley, or the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education in other cases, they found them to be totally bogus. But I quote Kenneth Marcus in the book saying that, you know, even if we lose, that's okay, because we're making it such a costly personal experience for students and for faculty and for universities to get engaged in the question of Palestine, to ask questions about why the United States is supporting Israel as it ethnically cleanses Palestinians. We make it so costly personally that it's just going to deter people from doing it. And so when you mentioned that student at the University of Michigan, the goal is to make an example of him. And it's to send a message to students and say, you know, don't do this, because we're going to splash your face and your name all over the internet, and you're never going to get a job, you're never going to have any prospects. But I think the amazing thing is that people are really getting the courage to stand up to it, and particularly students. I mean, again, here in California has been ground zero for this battle. It really has. And California was where the Irvine 11, 11 students were actually put on trial for standing up and protesting during a lecture by an Israeli ambassador. They were put on trial by Orange County prosecutors who put their top homicide prosecutor on the case for students who had disrupted a speech by a government official for 5 minutes. And that's 2 minutes. Okay, I was being generous, but 2 minutes is fine.
Fair man.
And actually, you discovered, Max discovered, that because they made all these claims that Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador, had been so distraught by this disruption that he had to leave the speech early. Max actually reported that the reason he was in a hurry was to make it to a Lakers game. And there was a...
I found that photo of him in the VIP lounge with Kobe Bryant.
And it was introduced at trial. But can you tell us, how distraught did Michael Oren look in that photo of Kobe Bryant?
He felt very unsafe.
But
his identity was threatened.
But, you know, seriously, it's real. It's, again, what it comes down to is, I think, a realization, tacit realization at least, by Israel and pro-Israel groups, that they can't win the argument, that, you know, the game is up if we have an open debate. I mean, it's the same reason why, you know, the reaction to Goliath was to try to marginalize you, defame you. Nobody could lay a finger on this book. You know, nobody. All the hit pieces that were done on Max's book, Goliath, nobody could lay a finger on it factually. In fact, Eric Altman of The Nation, when he attacked it, what did he say? What was the phrase he used about how it's all...
Technically factually accurate, however... It is the book of the month for the Hamas book club.
Yeah. Technically, factually accurate. Okay.
So,
Let's hear it. Welcome. Technical, factual accuracy.
This is the 35th meeting of the Hamas Book Club, so welcome. You mentioned the Brandeis Center. No affiliation with Brandeis, the institution of higher learning. I don't know if there's any higher learning going on at the Brandeis Center. It exists solely to smear people like us and attack students. They produced a 65-page paper asserting that I am, you know, a horrible human being, an anti-Semite to be blamed for everything from Miley Cyrus to restless leg syndrome. I did tip her off about the whole ratchet thing, so... No, it was 65 pages accusing me of anti-Semitism without actually questioning a single fact in my book, which is like 450 pages long, small print, so that my grandmother couldn't really read it, but her new husband did read it. Anyway, this is what the Brandeis Center does, but Rebecca Pierce, who's here, wrote a really important piece for Mondo Weiss about what the ultimate agenda of the Brandeis Center and groups like this are. And she found that the Brandeis Center is working with an organization called the American Society for Trustees and Alumni, which is a very anodyne-sounding name, which is funded by the Bradley Foundation based in Milwaukee, a right-wing foundation which funded the research that went into the Bell Curve, a book asserting that African Americans and Latinos are genetically inferior to whites, which has funded the whole attack on affirmative action, and which is run, the American Society for Trustees and Alumni is run, I think, by Lynn Cheney, the wife of, you know, Darth Vader. And their agenda is not just to attack Palestine solidarity on campus, but to actually shut down ethnic studies and to attack all progressive forms, all progressive spaces on campus, and all spaces that students of color are claiming as their own. So the issue is, when Students for Justice in Palestine is suspended and shut down, as they recently were at Northeastern after a long campaign by Charles Jacobs, who Ali mentioned, and they were just reinstated after this whole campaign was exposed. When that happens, there will be one less progressive ally when they come for the rest of us. We all know where it starts. It starts with Palestine, but we don't know where it ends. And Ali's exposed that in this book. I want to go to another issue and take it, you know, let's talk about students in Israel. Because at all of my talks, I rarely get heckled. Zionist students rarely speak up. Their talking points are easily knocked down. But there's always some group of them frantically typing in the corner, as if they type faster, then I'll be, you know, then I'll be delegitimized, or, you know, and some of them are writing in Hebrew, and I found that they've been employed by the Jewish Agency, and I've since learned that Haifa University and Tel Aviv University and the National Students Union in Israel are actually paying students to attack Palestine solidarity activists on social media and elsewhere, and they're even teaching courses on how to fight Palestine solidarity at Haifa University and Tel Aviv University. Israel has the highest rate of inequality of any OECD country. And for these students, there aren't that many opportunities. This is a good opportunity. It's a good job. So they're actually being sicked on us. Some of them have been personally assigned to me, and I know who they are, and they just won't go away. It's like herpes. And I mean,
I wouldn't know.
Yeah. We're in the Roxy Theater. So this speaks to, you know, a section in your book where you talk about greenwashing, blackwashing, and brownwashing, and pinkwashing. I think I've heard you say, you know, greenwash, blackwash, brownwash, pinkwash, hogwash. The Marker, which is an Israeli economics publication, it reports on the Israeli economy, has found that Israel invests over $100 million a year in a washing machine to basically This doesn't necessarily relate to the smears, but the image that Israel projects to the outside world in this post-Oslo era of what they describe as delegitimization. So talk about the washing machine and why you thought it was important to include that in your book.
Yeah. Anyone from the Israeli consulate here tonight? Well, they're in the book. The Israeli consulate in San Francisco makes a couple of cameos.
Is it Akiva Tor?
Yeah.
Akiva,
if you're there.
Akiva, if you're here.
Yeah. But this is important because the strategy laid out by groups like the David Project and another even more influential think tank called the Re'ut Institute. I mean, it sounds arcane, but so much of the stuff that you end up seeing and hearing on the radio or in the newspaper has been planned out at these think tanks. And a really important one is the Re'ut Institute, which published a strategy in 2010, which was adopted by the Israeli government as their official strategy. It was adopted by the major pro-Israel organizations in this country. And they said, basically, the major threat to Israel today is not military. It is from a growing global Palestine solidarity movement. And the risk that Israel faces is that within a few years, it will be isolated the way apartheid South Africa was in the 1980s. So we have to fight back. So they said we have to fight back. And they identified the left. They identified liberal, progressive, and left-wing communities as their targets. And Israeli military intelligence, this is something that has been openly admitted in the Israeli press, said we're going to monitor left-wing and progressive groups around the world and monitor them for what they call anti-Israel activity. But at the same time, there's kind of a carrot and stick strategy. We already talked about the stick, the intimidation, the lawsuits, this kind of thing. The carrot was to try to win over these progressive communities by marketing Israel, by using branding techniques to market Israel as this attractive product, particularly to young people and those perceived as progressive. So there's been a really aggressive campaign of what we call pinkwashing, which is trying to sell Israel as, a haven for LGBTQ rights. Much of this is totally bogus. I mean, when you actually look at Israel's record, it's really bogus. But the idea is to align Israel in the minds of people in the United States in particular with progressive causes and thereby to win their support. And it involves, of course, it's not just saying nice things about Israel, it's bad-mouthing everyone else. It's making a lot of false claims about Palestinians. So frequently you'll see claims that gay men are routinely hanged and executed by Palestinians, which is totally false.
Caroline Glick just claimed that gays are hanged in the center of Ramallah.
Yeah, this is just absolutely untrue. There's no recorded case of this. So that's the pinkwashing strategy, and that's where the Israeli consulate has gotten directly involved, as I mentioned, with the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival in San Francisco. But it's happened around the country. And it's this use by Israel of cultural products as a government strategy that really gives rise and legitimizes the Palestinian call for cultural boycott, which says that, when a government is intervening in stuff to prettify essentially apartheid, I mean, you'll hear this thing like, oh, well, there's no gay pride parade in Gaza. As if that justifies keeping 1.7 million people caged in and on the edge of hunger just because they're not Jewish. But that's what you're supposed to think. And with greenwashing, it's a similar strategy. Yesterday was Earth Day, and SodaStream, the Israeli company. Is that the sound of a carbonation? I think you need to replace your CO2 capsule. You know, SodaStream, an Israeli company that has a factory and a legal settlement where there's no environmental regulation, where Palestinian workers are exploited, where the very land the factory sits on has been stolen from Palestinians, is marketing itself as a green company. And the Earth Day Network, you know, endorsed it and partnered with it until Palestine solidarity activists made some noise and Earth Day dumped SodaStream. But that's how greenwashing works. So it's the idea that we're going to bully, intimidate, and smear people on the left, and at the same time we're going to sell Israel to them as a product. And part of the pinkwashing that has really been incredibly, I think, I'm at the loss for the word, but maybe it'll come to me, but is this deliberate marketing of Israel as a destination for sex tourism, and particularly for white male sex tourism, which is...
I wrote about that in Goliath, about Michael Lucas, who is the wealthiest... I think he may be the wealthiest porn producer in the world. He's certainly the wealthiest gay-oriented porn producer, and his top production was The Men of Israel, which is, you know, features male Israeli porn stars, and they shoot a scene in a village which your family is from, Lifta, which is one of the few really intact villages that were ethnically cleansed in 1947 and 1948, and Lucas and his film crew shot a scene in what they called an ancient home. It was actually, you know, an ethnically cleansed home. You know, in this, you know, this sort of... I'm not an academic. I bet Judith Butler could do this a lot better than I could. But it was sort of... I mean, this scene encapsulated the whole sick logic of pinkwashing in erasing Palestinian bodies and replacing them with this social Darwinistic image of a kind of more civilized culture, and doing so in a really obscene way that was insulting to the point that it denied that Palestinians had ever been there before. When Lucas appeared before the film crew, Channel One, the Israeli state TV, he was hailed as a kind of hero, bringing business to Israel and bringing positive PR. And Lucas has endorsed burnings of the Quran. He said that he hates Muslims. He is virulently anti-Palestinian. And he's not only heavily promoted by the pro-Israel lobby, but he leads gay tourism to Tel Aviv. So this is sort of... And he has helped shut down Palestine solidarity events in New York at the LGBT Center, threatening them with pulling a lot of the money that he donates.
In fact, the LGBT Center in New York, because of pressure from Lucas, I mean, they caved in, it was shameful. They actually banned any events related to Palestine for almost 2 years. So there were groups like Queers Against Israeli Apartheid that had been meeting in the LGBT Center in New York who were banned. When Sarah Schulman wanted to do a reading from her book about Palestine, that was banned. And it was after, you know, her book reading was banned that, and people have been protesting continuously for 2 years. Finally, they won a victory and the ban was overturned. But, I mean, it just goes to show that on this issue, even in spaces that are supposed to be safe, that are supposed to be open, that is supposed to bring those who have been marginalized and demonized into the center, Palestine gets excluded by this kind of bullying and thuggery.
And I mean, there's an underlying assertion that those who are not culturally advanced enough, who are not as liberal as Israel, deserve to be occupied and warehoused as human surplus permanently. It's a very dangerous logic that the campaign of pinkwashing is introducing, and that's widely accepted in liberal circles. You constantly hear this argument: well, Israel, you know, how would, you know, Hamas treat you? You know, this kind of argument I hear constantly. We see this argument appear in liberal publications and also in the New York Times. The New York Times is one of the key publications celebrating this false image of the good Israel. Now, you were, and I took their last correspondent, their last chief correspondent in Jerusalem, Ethan Bronner, to the woodshed. We didn't do it with insults or, you know, the kind of fabrications that camera...
No, we were just technically factually accurate.
And what you reported about him was that his son was in the Israeli army while he was reporting, and his job was to report on Israel-Palestine. So you can imagine, you know, if there was a Palestinian correspondent with a son in a Palestinian resistance faction, what would have happened? But, you know, another question is, what if his son had been taken captive, as Gilad Shalit was? What would he have done? How could he have reported objectively? And, of course, the New York Times public editor basically dismissed your finding.
No, that's not what happened.
Okay.
Let me refresh your memory.
Clarify.
We reported accurately that Ethan Bronner's son was a soldier in the Israeli army, and the public editor, who is the advocate for readers and, you know, the in-house critic, said that this was such a major conflict of interest that Ethan Bronner should be reassigned. They didn't say he should be fired. They said he should get a plum job as a New York Times bureau chief somewhere else. And it was Bill Keller at the time, I believe, who overruled that and just said, we don't care. And Ethan Bronner stayed there. And you reported about Ethan Bronner's business, essentially, with,
there was a pro-Israel PR firm based in Maale Adumim, which is an Israeli settlement, running Ethan Bronner's speakers bureau. So he had a business arrangement with a settler PR firm while he was covering Israel-Palestine for the New York Times. And I confused it with the public editor's statement basically dismissing what I reported. It's very hard to get fired from the New York Times. Just ask Judith Miller. So we come back to the New York Times Jerusalem Bureau and the post-Bronner era.
By the way, we move to the post-Bronner era, you know about my meeting with Ethan Bronner.
Well, why don't you indulge us?
I like telling this story. But actually, a few weeks ago, I was in New York, and I was invited to the New York Times, to the New York Times staff, off the record, call it the Death Star, the New York Times headquarters. So I was invited to the Death Star in Times Square to do a video interview for a film someone there was making. And when we were walking through the, you know, endless newsroom, I saw, several miles distance, Ethan Bronner, and I thought, well, this will be fun, I'll go and introduce myself. So I went up to him and I said, hello, Ethan Bronner, I'm Ali Abunam, and kind of did that. And he was talking to somebody else. I said, I don't mean to interrupt. He said, well, how do you know who I am? I said, well, I've seen your picture and I've seen you speaking in videos. I know what you look like. And then he turned to the person he was speaking to and he said, and he pointed to me and he said, this guy spends all his time criticizing me. And I said, well, you know, that's not true. I actually also spend a lot of time criticizing other people as well. And he said, well, I can't think of a time you've ever said anything nice about me. I said, well, can you think of a time I've ever said anything inaccurate about you? And one other point about the New York Times. about Brahma and his successors and his predecessors is that the house that the New York Times owns in Jerusalem, that is the residence for its bureau chief, is actually a property stolen from the Karmi family, a Palestinian family, a well-known family. The father who bought the house was a very well-known Palestinian broadcaster and intellectual. His daughter, Dr. Rada Karmi, is the author of several books. And their house, their property in West Jerusalem, is now occupied by the New York Times. So when Ethan Bronner's son would come home from his, you know, military service, he would come home to a house pillaged and looted from Palestinians.
I'm sorry, but that cuts off suddenly there.
For video of all 75 minutes of this very special event, it's actually posted on electronicintifada.net, but you need a longer URL. That URL is shown in the descriptive text associated with this audio posting.
That concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, which is a weekly segment here on WZBC Newton 90.3 FM, and this is part of Truth and Justice Radio. It airs every Sunday from 6 to 10 a.m. We hope that you'll join us again for news and views from and about Palestine.